This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Frank Buckley. Frank, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Frank. It's nice talking to you.
Hey, how are you doing?
And Jeff Crow will be joining us later in the show. He'll be simulcasting this on 1680 AM out of Fresno.
Cool.
So to start things off, Frank, you have a book out called The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America.
Yep.
Can you talk about your background and what are some of the issues that inspired you to write this book? It really tackles issues with the economy and income inequality.
Yeah. So what happened is this. So I've moved from Canada to the United States, and I was a stranger in a strange land. It seems to me that unless you've lived in other countries, you never quite understand your own country. And I've lived in both Canada and the United States and France, and I don't know anybody really understands Canada or the United States for that matter. You have to move around to figure it out. One thing I noticed right away is this is really, in America, this is something of a class society. In a way, it really wasn't in Canada. I mean, there was a greater sense of equality, and if you kind of look at the numbers, it's not just a sense of equality. There's greater equality economically, I think socially, and more importantly, in terms of mobility, intergenerational mobility, which means will your kids do better than you did? And, you know, that's used to be the case here. It was called the American Dream. But, you know, now it's called the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe in it. It's really fled to other countries. Other countries are far more mobile than we are. We are kind of up there with Britain in terms of being immobile, that is, kids being rooted in the same economic class as their parents. And the really highly mobile societies are countries like Denmark and Canada. And so I thought, well, you know, this is your, it's not just the American dream. It's kind of how you identify yourself as an American. I mean, we're the country where whoever you are, wherever you're from, you can get ahead. And that's just, you know, that's just a load of, you know what.
Did you write this book in response to the 2012 election and Mitt Romney's failure with his message?
Yeah, right. Pretty much. I mean, you know, look, I'm teaching at a fairly conservative school. It's really a right-wing libertarian school. I'm none of the above. And Mitt Romney, of course, was very much a representative of that. And, you know, I think after living here for a while, I finally figured out how these guys think. I used to think they'd go back to John Locke and they'd kind of work it out from first principles. And you know, with more experience with these guys, I thought, no, that's not it. You know, what it is they start by saying, what is the meanest goddamn thing we can do? And that's what they do. So there you go. Mitt Romney, Mr. I like to fire you, and Mr. 47% of Americans are snorers, you know, takers. And yeah, that's just despicable, right? And they got that. I mean, you know, Mitt didn't just invent that. He got that from some of the smartest right-wingers around, the people at the American Enterprise Institute. That's what they were saying. And, it just expressed a heck of a lot of contempt. And Obama, by contrast, came across as the guy who had your back. Now, it turned out, yeah, you know, he may have tried, but he didn't really have your back in the sense that his policies didn't do a heck of a lot. But you had one guy who, you know, who seemed to care, and the other guy who couldn't care less. And that was the story of a 2012 election. And the Republican establishment really didn't have a clue, which is why I cottoned towards Trump. I wanted somebody who was going to break it all up, okay? And Trump was somebody whom I thought would do exactly that. But whoever it is, I mean, I kind of like to declare war from the Republican Party against the Republican establishment and all the libertarian right-wingers and the Freedom Caucus and all that.
You don't necessarily have a ideological reason for being, say, a conservative Republican. you're just saying from a practical stance, you see it as more workable to implement change within the Republican Party.
Well, I'd frankly like to see people meeting in the middle from both parties on some of these issues. I've written, for example, that I think that Trump should adopt single-payer health care, which is what I was familiar with in Canada. And there's just so much nonsense peddled about what the Canadian system, the Canadian health care system is like. And I know it. And it's great. You know, it really works pretty well. And it's not as good as Blue Cross. But you know what? The average spending per person in Canada on health care is $4,500. And here it's $9,500. So if you ramped up Canadian spending to American levels, what you'd get is something, I think, vastly superior even to what we have. Plus, you know, it wouldn't be so completely heartless as some of the plans that are being pushed around right now, plans which, for example, discriminate against people who have pre-existing conditions. Trump said he wasn't going to do that. Trump said he kind of liked the Canadian system, but he's stuck with dealing with these guys in Congress. And I think, you know, I'm hoping it all falls apart. I'm hoping that he can't get a deal through, and I'm hoping that at that point he approaches the Dems and says, okay, guys, you know, it's time to fish or cut bait. You've been talking about rescuing Obamacare, and I tell you what, I'll see you Obamacare, and I'll raise you Canadian Medicare.
It's important to point out, I mean, most prosperous developed countries, I think you even pointed it out, even the countries that the Cato Institute lists as being the most free market, all those nations have some degree of a single-payer health care.
Everybody, we're dropping by, you know, like a rock in measures of economic freedom. Everybody ahead of us, we're number 17, everybody ahead of us has some kind of single-payer, some kind of government health care, and it works fine. And, part of the problem here is if we are dropping like a stone in measures of freedom, and freedom's not the only value around, but hey, it counts. There are other things going on that are more important than Medicare, and the right wing kind of obsesses over small stuff, and it kind of misses the big picture. And the big picture goes to things like corruption in government, the rule of law, regulatory state on steroids, you know, none of which you really have so much in a lot of other countries that are ahead of us in terms of those rankings. So, you know, look, you know, the message is, why don't you focus, you know, you right wingers on, if you're so, you know, interested in liberty, why don't you focus on why it is that we royally suck and forget about things that don't seem to matter? I'll tell you one thing. When you go and talk to conservatives in another country, none of them would want to give up health care. I mean, I know the Tories in Canada, none of them would want to give up Canadian Medicare. Margaret Thatcher, kind of right-wing queen, she wasn't going to touch national health in Britain. You know, and it's not just once you've got it, you're stuck with it. It's more like once you got it and work with it, you see it works. And you see how it's popular. And you don't want to be so heartless as to take it away. So, I the other thing here, by the way, is, you know, we are incredibly generous, the United States is, in terms of welfare. Like, we spend more per capita than Canada on welfare. But the thing is, it's hidden in all these programs. And the programs are a bit of a mess because they're like 72 federal programs, a bunch of state programs. And it's like, you know, the right hand shouldn't know what the left is doing. And it's more like the right wing shouldn't know what the left has done. You know, the left has passed all these welfare reforms. And I don't say they're bad. It's just, you know, it's messy when you have 72 of them. I think it's a lot neater just to have one, you know, a couple of big programs like Medicare. So, you know, rather than Medicaid and VA and American Medicare. So, you know, my proposal roughly would be, what you do roughly is you give everybody a kind of a credit card, a health card. And, you know, and there you can do things to make it work better than in Canada. You can, I mean, copay makes some sense. So, I mean, there are all these details where you can tweak it and make it a little better. But in general, the problem is, you know, the Republicans here, number one, obsess over kind of the fine print. And number two, they really are effective at conveying the image of being totally heartless. Boy, they do that really well. You asked, am I ideological? Well, no. You know, I'm like a, you know, I hate to confess, I'm like a Canadian Tory or a British Tory. You know, I don't have, I want to see what works.
Looking at Donald Trump's message, he was very successful getting elected on a lot of these strong kind of economic populist ideas. He's talked about things like Glass-Steagall, and I think he's even talked about nationalized healthcare at some point. And his big issue was trade, and his success was winning working class voters in these crucial swing states. But now there's a lot of concern that he's just going back to the kind of same old Republican Party policies that the Chamber of Commerce and the donor class wants. I mean, you've actually known Trump personally. What are
I've seen him. I've been to the White House. I've seen him at the White House. I know his kids. I'm not an intimate friend or anything like that. But I wrote speeches for him. Okay, I wrote about four or five speeches for him, and I wrote speeches for the kids, and I've advised on transition stuff. And I'm sort of, you know, I'm like a couple of degrees of separation away. And in terms of your concern, I think the bigger problem, there are a couple of problems. One problem is he got into the White House, you know, without really any kind of establishment team behind him, which is good and bad. I mean, you didn't want these guys, but the way the White House is working right now is there are very few people right at the top who are ultimately making decisions. The guys who are really learning on the job is not so much Trump. It's people like Tillerson and McMaster and Mattis, right? The secretaries. And, you know, it's a work in progress more for them. And on occasion, they've had to have their hands slapped by the White House. But it's not no way to run a railroad. You can't have all the micro decisions made in the State Department run up to the White House with, you know, in the White House saying, no, you can't do that. So, you know, there's that's happening. And the other thing is he's got a legislative agenda, Trump does, and that means dealing with Congress. And you see how it's working out with the Republicans in Congress right now. I mean, that's why I hope he reaches out to the Dems.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem, is a lot of people are angry at Trump, but Trump can't really implement a strong agenda if he doesn't have support from the Congress. The problem is, on one side, the majority of the Democrats are hostile towards him, and then the majority of the Republicans are pushing this, like, Paul Ryan Chamber of Commerce agenda. So he has only a small handful of people in Congress.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, he's hemmed in. On the Democratic side, he's got some guys who are, you know, they're still in the anger stage, okay? I mean, they should take a Valium. I mean, you've got some guys like Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut who wants to commence litigation on the basis that Trump can't be president because of the Emoluments Clause, which is just a total loser, but you know, it suggests a party in deep denial. However, so what do you do then? Well, you don't give up. What you do at that point, if you're Trump and you can't deal with Ryan, is you say, okay, guys, you know, here's what I'm willing to do. You Dems have been talking about rescuing Obamacare. Let's do it. And you want to know something? This is the way the White House is thinking right now. So I'm letting you into a secret. The White House right now figures that if Ryan Care 2 goes down, the message at that point is, let's think carefully about Canadian-style Medicare. And by the way, let me, you know, can I tell you an anecdote about how it works in Canada? Because my mother died recently, age 104, okay, in Toronto. And so I was schlepping up to Toronto like every 2 months. And, you know, I'd go see her. In the last 6 months of her life, she'd have a slip and fall like once a month, you know, and so she'd be brought to the hospital by an ambulance, and the hospital in question looks better and more sophisticated than anything in the DC area. Okay. So they keep her in, and they'd say, well, you didn't break anything, but you know something, while you're here, we're going to test your kidneys a little bit. I'm kind of worried about your kidneys. So in the last 6 months of her life, 1 week a month, she was in this really, really super duper hospital. Okay. So this is like the Cadillac of all Cadillac services, right? I mean, 104-year-old person, they weren't giving up. Okay. They were giving her, you know, they were giving her absolutely prime treatment. So it's not so bad. I mean, there are things that have to be fixed in Canada, but remember the basic thing is we're spending twice as much as they are. By the way, they're more satisfied than we are with, they're more satisfied with Canadian Medicare than we are with the American healthcare system. If you move to single payer, you'd save about 15% on administrative costs, about $500 billion, according to the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's a deal waiting to happen. You got a deal maker in charge. It's kind of an exciting time. Excuse me. For example, we're dealing with China right now over North Korea. And we've done a complete pivot. I mean, Trump a year ago was saying China is a big time offender. And now we're working closely with China and we're not pressing trade matters with China. And Trump has told us, I mean, I was in a small meeting where he announced we're not going to do that while they're helping us with North Korea. That comes first. I like that kind of flexibility.
As far as healthcare goes, one crucial point that it's important to make is that single payer is more fiscally responsible than either Ryancare or Obamacare, because that's basically like crony capitalism, where you're forcing people to subsidize private insurance companies. But another idea that would be sensible would be to have insurance as a public utility.
Yeah, people worry about the want of competition. Actually, here's the way it works in Canada is, you know, everybody gets this kind of a credit card, Medicare card. And it's like a credit card. There are no copays, which is a mistake. But anyway, you go in, you pick your doctor. The doctor is private. You pick your hospital, or the doctor does. The hospital is private. So the doctors and the hospitals are competing for patients, unlike Britain, which is everybody's a civil servant, right? It's totally nationalized. So, you know, what the Canadians did is they eliminated the insurance companies, but they kept competition at the level of the providers. So, you know, look, if you're a terrible doctor, okay, you're not going to get clients. If you're a grouch and you scare people away, you won't get clients. And hospitals compete with one another. And then they have to negotiate with the government with respect to, the extent to which they're funded. So it's sort of a mixed capitalist system. But I mention that only as a, by way of contrasting Trump with the Romneys of the world. And of course, Romney had his own health care plan, but it didn't work terribly well.
Welcome to Spotlight of the Valley with your host, Jeff Crow. In this hour, Jeff Crow and his guests will be digging deep into the issues you care about. So without further ado, here's Jeff Crow.
Yeah, Woody, I love it.
Well, thank you.
Folks, I have been away from the microphone for about 2 years, give or take. That's right. And as usual, you are the awesome ones, as I refer to my audience. And we are joined here today on 1680 AM Fresno by Robert Stark, who most of you will remember has been an on-again and off-again co-host, and sometimes I've been his co-host for his shows.
Yes.
And he has a co-host of his own. Welcome, welcome. And then our widely esteemed guest today is Mr. Frank Buckley. Hello, Frank.
Howdy.
And Frank is a foundation professor at George Mason University School of Law, and he has also done a few other things, minor things in life, including writing a being a speechwriter for this guy we don't really know about, but apparently his name is Trump something. I think it's Donald Trump Jr. So if you all have heard of him, congratulations. Being sarcastic, of course, obviously, you know, he's the son of our president.
Right.
And thank goodness we have a new president here, and hopefully we'll see a good 4 to 8 years of greatness, making America great and everything else, too, in the process. So, anyhow, we're jumping in the middle of the Stark Truth radio show, which is at which you can find at www.starktruthradio.com. So let's carry on here. Folks, we'll jump right in. So anyhow, real quick, if I may ask you, Mr. Buckley, how did you initially get into contact with the Trump family and whatnot?
Well, I knew Jeff Sessions. He wanted a list of judges to recommend to the president for the Supreme Court. So I knew some. I knew I had a judges program, so I knew some judges. And along the way, I appended a speech. We had a little writing team here composed of my wife and one other fellow. And in the end, we wrote at least first drafts of about 5-6 speeches for Donald Trump. And then for, I also did Don Jr. at the convention, and I did a first draft of the Ivanka speech, although I never really got in touch with my inner millennial on that one. And then I worked on, no, it didn't work. I volunteered some advice on transition matters. So, and I was at the White House a couple of days back to see Trump in action. Very impressive guy, very, very impressive. You know, if you see him on the podium, he's very forceful. And but this was a Q&A session with about 40 odd journalists, and he's just very sharp, very well informed.
Oh, I love how he handles the media in particular. I haven't seen this type of guy in the office of the presidency since I was a kid, which would be during the Reagan era. But back then, I was a little too young to really care about politics. But really, this is the way he's able to handle these, a very hostile media at that, is just, it's almost a work of art, you know, an art form to him. So,
well, yeah, he's very adept at it, in a way few presidents were. I would think John Kennedy was quite good. You know, of course, there was FDR, and since we're at the 100-day mark tomorrow, a lot of people are asking to compare Trump with the first 100 days of FDR's administration in 1933. That's kind of the gold standard. But what a lot of people miss about FDR is his first 100 days, it was about 4 pieces of legislation, but it was much more than that. I mean, he really turned the country around in terms of instilling a sense of optimism in the country.
Yes.
And that's basically the story of Trump as well. I mean, the Conference Board reports that consumer confidence is at its highest level since the year 2000. The National Association of Manufacturers reports that about 92% of businesses in the NAM are either very confident or somewhat confident as to how they'll do in the future. That's the highest level ever. Stock market is up 15% since November 8th. You know, and I guess nobody's really thinking it, but everybody's thinking, my God, it's not Hillary's first 100 days.
Oh, wow.
So so we have a sense of things that are possible that we didn't have before, and Americans are feeling good about their country. They're feeling better about their country than they have for some time.
Yeah, I don't think we really had that sense of optimism since, I mean, possibly maybe the 80s, but definitely the 50s. Is that why you kind of chose the New York skyline in the 1950s to really kind of portray that era and the sense of optimism they had for the future?
You know, somebody who lived in New York, I guess it was New York in the 40s or 50s, and I had to pay, by the way, an extra $200 for the photo on the book, but it was worth it. It's this Empire State Building in the clouds, the fog, and the, you know, the message is of, you know, this is a fabulous country, but it's somewhat obscured a little of late. But it's still there, and we can get it back. That was what I wanted to convey, and that's what I feel about the country. I mean, you never want to, you know, however bad it looks, you never bet against it, and it's still the greatest country in the world.
Earlier on, we were talking about how America does have some of the worst levels of mobility and income inequality in the developed world. If you look at these countries you pointed out, like Denmark, that have, I saw this chart posted on a blog the other day that shows the percentage of the country that, of a country that's in the middle class, upper class, or lower class. And I think we're at the bottom of developed nations for the middle class. Denmark is, I think, at the top, and England is fairly low too. But what are some of the key economic factors why we're so far at the bottom compared to those other countries?
Frank Fukuyama says, you know, the moral of public policy, he says, is called getting to Denmark, because it's sort of, you know, Denmark is kind of like the Utah of countries. It just kind of gets everything right. But the point is, we're not Denmark, or we're even close, right? We're a very different kind of country.
Right. Yeah,
so the obvious comparison is Canada. I mean, there's no country that more closely resembles the United States. And if major film studios want to open a movie, they'll do it at the Toronto Film Festival, because that's the best measure of how a film will succeed in the North American market. And when I looked at the two countries, Canada very mobile, America quite immobile, the difference is at the bottom 10% and the top 10%. And at the bottom 10%, parents pass on their poverty to their kids. And in the top 10%, you've got a kind of an aristocracy where if your parents were in the top 10%, you've got an almost 50% chance of being in the top 10 or 20%. And by comparison in Canada, it's, you know, it's very level. It's just, if your parents were in the top 10%, hey, you may end up in the bottom 10%. You've got a real shot at that.
What is the trend with the increase of people who are previous middle class, and say their parents were middle class, and now they're basically entering the underclass?
There's a lot of that. It's mostly the top and the bottom 10% where you see the action. Apart from that, there's been a phenomenon of jobs disappearing. But, you know, the reason why it's interesting to compare our country with Canada is it tells you, you know, where the problems are. For example, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, you know, we have a problem of disappearing middle class, but, you know, this is all about, we moved to a high-tech world with high-tech jobs, and, you know, the guys in the machine shop, they're getting left behind. Okay. You know, the only thing is, they're not exactly living in the Stone Age in Canada or Denmark, and somehow they say they don't have this problem. Right. So that's all nonsense. So, you know, I then looked more carefully and I thought, well, you know, let's just see what makes people mobile or not. And the first one is a good education system. So our K-12 system is terrible. You know, it's not a function of money. We throw a lot of money at it. It doesn't make a difference. You know, what it is schools that are held captive by teachers' unions and parents who don't have a choice. It's you know, it's a Stalinist system. And other countries basically have choice. I mean, I came down here, my daughter was five, and so we put her into a public school here. But had we stayed in Canada, in Montreal, we would have a choice between all of these states, state-supported, okay? Kind of an English public school, a French public school, an English Catholic school, a French Catholic school, a Jewish school, all of which are, you know, full freight, fully paid by the states. So, which means competition, right? I mean, it's so, you know, here you've got a Stalinist system, there you have competition. So that's number one. Number two,
so
immigration.
You're kind of talking about this interesting hybrid system where it's subsidies and helping people out combined with competition kind of the best dynamics of the public sector combined with the competition of the private sector.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's interesting. We have some charter schools here in the district, and there's not enough. I mean, there's a tremendous desire to get into them. You know, a lot of pent-up demand, not enough places in the charter schools. But in the public school system, parents, the principals go door-to-door to try to persuade people to go to public school. Yeah, that's competition.
Yeah, that's for sure. The and one of the other factors, and by the way, folks, we have on the radio site here, we have 2 minutes before we'll be going to a break, just so the audience knows. They're going to carry on the interview, and then after the commercial break, we'll just pick up where they're already at. There's a factor there where we have had a constant influx of immigrants, and obviously ours are coming from the Latin American and Asian countries primarily. Europe traditionally has not had that up until very, very recent, and that's a benefit in some ways, our ability to acculturate folks and whatnot is a lot better. But that also factors into some of our education statistics. If you separate out the immigrant population, which it's obviously a little bit harder to educate initially with language barriers, instead you measure our homogenous indigenous population versus theirs, typically we're around the same level from what I have seen.
Well, we're importing immobility. I mean, we have the craziest immigration system in the world, right? I mean, it's just,
right.
You know, it's
that's
absolute
one thing
nonsense.
That got Donald elected.
And we're importing immobility. In other words, we're bringing into this country people who will not earn as much as Americans, and their children will not earn as much as the children of native-born Americans. And the effect goes on to the third generation. And
right.
That doesn't happen in Canada, which has its point system. Trump has said, look, I'd love to adopt the Canadian system. I know how it works. I mean, I'm familiar with it. It's a system that has one defining characteristic. Whether you get in or not depends on whether or not you will add to the welfare of native-born Canadians, right? Which
right.
is something that's
right
pretty irrelevant
that.
Here.
With immigration, a lot of people talk about the kind of distinction between legal and illegal immigration, but it's not within politics. Very few people, with the exception of possibly Jeff Sessions, are really addressing like the issue of the sheer numbers. I think the United States takes in well over 1 million people legally. Then you have the illegal immigration added to that, so the numbers are massive.
We're back.
Yeah, the absolute numbers don't matter so much. It's more quality than quantity. So the quality is terrible. And, you know, I mean, look, if you know, at this point, Canada is about 20% foreign-born. Australia is about 25% foreign-born. We're about 14%. So, you know, we're not exactly the country of immigrants. The other countries
like,
are that.
Like we used to be, certainly. When we used to bring in immigrants from Ireland or Italy in particular, it was traditionally massive waves. But then again, we had a continent we were trying to fill up, so to speak. Can I ask you this? Because we only have about 10 minutes on our remaining segment for this part of the show. If you would, could you go over a little bit of what it was like working behind the scenes with the Trump family in terms of the GOP convention and the transition period, or anything else you'd like to add to that?
Well, some of it remains confidential. I'm writing a book on the subject, so I don't want to give it away.
Whatever you
it was
can
a fascinating experience
John,
because
anything by the Secret Service.
If you want to be a speechwriter, it's not about yourself; it's about the guy you're writing the speech for.
Right.
So you try to meld your style into his. I think we succeeded. In terms of ideas, we are completely on board with his ideas. So that worked. And I remember the first time we did a speech, it was the foreign policy speech that he gave in just about almost exactly a year ago in D.C. And we were there and we're kind of pinching ourselves when we heard our lines, you know, some of those lines. He said he was going to go after ISIS. I won't tell him when and I won't tell him how. You know, I mean, we heard our lines and of course, we were just saying things that he wanted to say. But it sure felt great. And afterwards, we repaired into a reception. And I sat beside a couple of Republican bigwigs, and they kind of looked at me like, who the fuck are you? Pardon my French. And they said, I know who wrote that speech. Nobody had a clue about us. Nobody had a clue. So it was nice being on background. You know, we didn't want to advertise. So we did a number of those things. And then afterwards, there were some special problems with respect to the foreign policy team. And there's a story there, very roughly, without getting into too much detail, the people who were appointed to run the Trump foreign policy team were totally inadequate to the task. And so they had to be replaced. So, and they were. You know, the moral, the basic idea would be there are two ways of doing foreign policy. One model is you have a very strong Secretary of State. And the other model is you have basically an office administrator, Secretary of State, and the real work is done out of the National Security Council. That model is William P. Rogers at State and Henry Kissinger at NSC. And the initial idea was Flynn at NSC and Tillerson at State. And Tillerson would be basically the office manager type. But Flynn self-destructed.
Right.
And Tillerson is learning on the job. He's made a number of errors. He's accustomed to working across the aisle with people of both parties. That's particularly true of military people. If you're in the military, you are trained to be apolitical, so you make friends on both sides. And that characterizes Mattis. I mean, look, you know, what Mattis had going for him was his nickname, basically. I mean, his eminent qualities, but that, yeah. It was his nickname that got him the job.
Reincarnated.
Yeah, so the thing about Mattis is someone who has been not quite on board the Trump team in some respects, with respect to, for example, some of his hires. He wanted to hire Michel Flournoy, who would probably have been Hillary's Secretary of State. At that point, you ask yourself, why did we have an election? He wanted to hire Ann Patterson, who was the ambassador to Obama's ambassador to Egypt, and who kind of liked the Muslim Brotherhood. So there were occasions where those people had to be not quite read the right act, but gently told, no, this is not going to work. So, you know, part of the confusion with respect to the administration up to now, it's not that Trump doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what's happening. The problem is it's a learning experience for the Tillersons and the Mattises. And and then you have to deal with Congress.
Yeah, Bill Clinton had a similar problem in his first 100 days, really his first year, and it cost him Congress with how much he was stumbling over things. And then you have George W. Bush. He had some issues, especially coming off a contentious election, which in retrospect is nothing like the contentious nature of this last one. So when all is said, I think that, you know, for his first 100 days, it's good enough. And if it's on the right path, that's what matters. We got about 2 minutes left on the radio clock here. So just for our radio audience, and then you carry on with Stark Truth Radio, how can folks get a hold of your books and whatnot, and anything else that you'd like to throw in, so that
sure. Well, the website is fhbuckley.com, but importantly, you can get on Amazon and pick up my latest book, The Way Back. Trump praised the book, and I think it probably better than any book explains what's behind the thinking of a Trump administration. And it's cheap at half the price.
Mr. Stone's book?
Pardon me?
Even better than Roger Stone's insider book, right?
Yeah. there aren't too many people. You know, there are people who've talked about nationalism, but they haven't quite figured out what it's all about.
Ah, yes, very, very good, extremely good. In a country like the USA, where we've always had immigration and assimilation, nationalism is a lot harder to define than homogeneous populated countries.
Well, what it means is, let's look after our own. Let's look after our own more than anybody, more than we look after people from other countries.
Absolutely.
Buy American, hire American.
I love it. America first. So hopefully he stays on that path, and, you know, we'll see where he goes and stay on top of it. On behalf of our audience here at 1680 in Fresno, we appreciate you joining us there. And, what was your website address real quick again?
fhbuckley.com.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. And thank you, Robert.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, enjoy.
Thanks, Jeff, and I'll post the full interview on my website.
There you go, folks. You heard it.
Thank you so much.
This is Spotlight on the Valley, and hopefully you guys like the first go-around.
Yeah.
We will be on every week here on 1680. Well, hey, my producer loves it. So
I love it.
I got one vote. One vote in the house. Yeah.
Well, I'm helping you produce it. I'm supposed to love it.
That's right. And
we'll be right back, folks.
And we will be right
back.
You recently wrote about the college issue. The article was titled "The College Scam: How Boomers Betrayed Millennials." And we've seen this dramatic increase in college admissions, but there's been a massive decline in the value of diploma. You have large numbers of students who are in a massive amounts of debt and are unemployed or working underemployed. And college has become this massive for-profit industry for both the administrators and also for Wall Street. What do you see as the key problems, and what do you offer as some of the solutions?
Well, it's not really a Wall Street issue much. It's actually more an issue of public colleges and private colleges, which have run up the tuition way, way, way more than the cost of living, and aren't delivering quality. And then once you graduate, the jobs aren't there. So you graduate, the jobs aren't there. You have tremendous debt, and the worst thing is you can't burn it off in bankruptcy. Up till about 1976, student debt loads could be discharged in Chapter 7, and they changed the law in 76. Why? Well, you know, back then tuition wasn't a big deal, number one. And number two, there were jobs waiting when you graduated, so it wasn't exactly a big deal. And there were student loan programs. So I guess the thinking was, well, if you're going to get these loans, you know, you shouldn't be able to discharge the debt. But now, as I say, you've got the worst of all possible worlds. You've got incredible tuition. You don't have a good education. You don't have the jobs. You put it all together, it seems to me to argue for bankruptcy. Let students burn off their debt loads in bankruptcy, because the alternative is making debt slaves out of people. I mean, If the way it is, you know, if all your earnings go to pay off your debt load, then you're basically a slave. You have no incentive to work, really. There also are these gimmicks. For example, if you're doing public works, if you're in some, you know, kind of a public service employee of some kind, then you get a break. But the way it works is that kind of makes a peon of you. In other words, if you start in that program and give it up, all of a sudden all that debt load is due, so you're locked into whatever it is you do, you know, like being a teacher, whatever. You can't You can't work up to something in private enterprise. So it's just a horrible system in that respect. Other countries tackle this problem in a very simple way. You know, about 50 years back, every country said, okay, we got to do something about getting kids into college. It's sort of a good deal. But every other country made the following deal with the colleges. They said, okay, we're going to guarantee student loans. You, however, have to cap your tuition. And so in other countries, you know, it's a public-private partnership. The university has to essentially get the approval of the government to increase tuition. What that means is that, you know, it's just a lot cheaper in other countries. It also means that universities here are richer. What does that mean? Well, it means that you can have luxurious dorms. It means that you can hire superstar faculty. So there's a lot of rating from other countries. And it also means you can hire just an incredible number of administrators to do it, you know, whatever the useless things administrators do. One of the great changes in American education is formerly, you know, it was just a matter of principal plus maybe one vice principal and the janitor and then a bunch of teachers. And now there are typically more administrators of one kind or another than there are teachers in a K-12 school and certainly in a university. Just pure waste. You know, if you give people, you know, money, they find all sorts of stupid ways of spending it. You probably know, you know, there's this apocryphal story you've probably heard about New York separate schools, Catholic schools. You know, somebody phoned up, the Catholic school system of New York and said, we'd like to know how many administrators you have for the whole New York area. And the guy says, okay. And then there's silence on the line. And then you hear the guy saying, 7, 8, 9 is the answer, right? It's like when you don't have a lot, you can get by. When you're rolling in money and you don't know what to do with it, then you throw it away at stupid stuff.
One more topic contributing to economic problems in the future is one of the issues that we're going to tackle is automation. Besides concerns about issues like outsourcing of jobs, this will be probably the number one economic issue of the future. I mean, some people have proposed a basic income. Do you see that as being necessary if we see widespread?
No, I think that's a terrible idea. By the way, first of all, you know, automation hits every country the same way, right? Like I say, they're not living in Stone Age elsewhere. But somehow, you know, other countries manage it and we don't. So there's other stuff going on. But with respect to kind of a guaranteed wage, that's just the worst thing in the world. Let me explain why. It's like we're going to throw some money at you, and then we don't care about you. We're going to give you whatever the basic is. Well, you know, we'll give you $40,000 a year, and then you can go to hell. You got cancer? Tough. Let's see. It's not like that. There are some people who, you know, will have special needs, and $40,000, whatever the number might be, won't cover it. And then there's some people who, you know, who think $40,000 a year is sort of pretty good. Now I'm going to loaf. And those are guys who should be out working. So, no, so a guaranteed income of that kind, no, that's immoral. It's immoral because it shows, it's really a way, it's really a cop-out. It's really a way of conveying your indifference to people. If we give you this, then we don't have to think about you. You know, and if you have cancer afterwards, well, you know, die in the streets. No. And it's also a way of saying, you know, you guys are a bunch of slobs and you're not going to work, so we'll give you money and the heck with you. And that's terrible because there's something noble about work. I mean, people should have jobs. And they should never be paid not to work.
Do you think automation will wipe out like a large portion of our economy, or do you think we'll adapt and it'll lead to the creation of new jobs, in the science fields?
There'll be a move towards service economy. this is a subject for futurologists, and you know what? That's not a science. That's nothing. I don't see much point speculating about the future. But with that, I got to leave you.
Frank Buckley, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
All right. Take care. Good talking to you guys.
Good night.
Thanks. Bye.